Blog Talk Radio.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. All three engines up and burning. 2, 1, 0, and liftoff.
Coach on Fire Radio.
Fire the fire.
Hello, this is Dave Briglio with Making the Play, and this is the show where we bring together a lot of like-minded coaches, mentors, teachers here who want to focus on helping kids get a much better experience out of sports, school, and prepare them for life. So my guests today are with Mindy and Paul McCord from Jacksonville University, coaches of the women's lacrosse team. Do we have Mindy and Paul on?
Hello.
Hey, Paul.
This is Paul.
How you doing?
How
do we have
doing?
Mindy as well? I'm good.
I think Mindy's trying to dial on right now. So hopefully she'll get on here in a minute or two.
Okay. And, well, let me give a little bit of an introduction here. I'm Jacksonville. And, my daughters, I've mentioned in the last show when we were talking about the Positive Coaching Alliance. My daughters are playing lacrosse, and a wonderful group I ran into were the McCords. And they are involved with women's lacrosse at all levels. As I'm trying to get Mindy here online, Paul, why don't you describe, let's just talk about the itself at Jackson University, I guess, how you all got it started and the history.
Sure. Well, the program started, oddly enough, I was doing a football talk radio program, and I was talking about lacrosse being a great sport that every university should have. And one of the athletic directors was listening at JU at the time, and he called me and asked if Mindy and I would come in and talk about starting lacrosse at the university. He had heard that we had done a lot of lacrosse work in the community. So it was kind of a no-brainer. I had put together a business model that I had been sending out to colleges, how to start lacrosse, and was trying to help grow the sport because we had gotten so many kids interested in playing it in our area that we wanted to help find college opportunities for the kids that played it. And Mindy and I had both been collegiate lacrosse coaches in addition to other sports. So it was really just a passion of ours, and Mindy and I were active in youth leagues, and Mindy was really the show. I was more of an organizer and referee and coach when I was needed, but Mindy really got everyone's hearts swollen with lacrosse, and she was really the driver behind the sport. And so we started the program at JU, and this is our eighth season now.
Yeah, and I think, Mindy, do we have you on the line now?
Yes, I'm here, Dave. Can you hear me?
Yep. Working great. Excellent. And being me located here now in mid-Atlantic, there's obviously lacrosse all over the place here, but what a lot of guys in that Florida are a couple impressive Division I teams, and you've come a long way in 8 years. I think it was just maybe 2 or 3 years ago, had the highest scoring offense in Division I think it was. So as we kind of stick on talking about the collegiate team, you know, how, other than having a business plan to start a team that attracts some girls that, you know, may want to be playing lacrosse at the beach, how do you deal with starting from nothing and really, again, making sure that, as we've talked about so many times, it wasn't just about lacrosse. It was about developing these girls coming in at 18 into young women leaving in their early 20s, which, again, is really what we want to focus on here. Tell me maybe a little about what you, the things you've learned most over these last 8 or 10 years.
Well, Dave, I could maybe address that a little bit. You know, I'm starting a program from scratch. The fun, challenging part about that is you're not inheriting any players, but then you're acquiring like 21 freshmen. And we didn't really have any true transfers except one who was a freshman at the time. And when you get to do that and you get to build your culture and really an identity of what you want this experience to be like and what would be attractive to the school in terms of the type of player you're getting, but also what can the student athlete get out of this experience in school. So we really tried to reach out to other schools that had start programs within the last 5 years and learn what their mistakes were and learn what they did well and try to use that as a catalyst, as well as Paul worked with the team on two areas that I thought was very beneficial in establishing a program, which was an axiology assessment, which helps to see the kind of personality styles as a player and how they think about the game and design your systems around that. And you know, taking the speed programs that he had learned as director of velocity sports performance into the college level. So being out of the game for a little while and more focusing on an area where we were able to develop skill sets and strengths was a value. And then, you know, Paul really highlighted the community that we were going to be a school that was going to recruit players from the South and grow the South and help to give these kids in the state of Florida and, you know, in other areas in the South an opportunity to go to college and play. And so that bigger mission and vision was a way that we could say we were changing lives inside and out, which has always been one of our mottos.
And, you know, I'm looking at something that you sent to me earlier today, your list of core values. I'm not going to go through all 10, but I think these are important for people to hear because, again, you know, they'll think about collegiate sports. You know, yes, you talked about, you know, footwork and things like that, but you're talking about number one on the list. We choose to be positive. Going a little further down, you talk about there are no unimportant details. We're a team of grace. We mean no offense, and we take no offense, and we are friends and champions. I mean, those things in there, again, there's, you know, the usual, you know, try hard, and we always think about that about sports and never, you know, say die spirit, but those are things you don't always really see in here. And what led you to these core values? Did that come out at the beginning, or these develop over the years?
We actually, it's funny, Mindy was on maternity leave with our second child, and so I was kind of in charge, a scary thought. But the first thing I thought of was, okay, so I'm in charge of a women's lacrosse team, and I'm a big, burly guy. What is our team all about? What are the core values of our team? And I wanted to make a difference spiritually with our team and connect with them on a different level than just being a coach of a sport. I wanted the sport to matter. So I read a book, and I recommend this book for any coach out there. It's called The Messiah Method, and it's done by Dave Brandt and some of the other Messiah College coaches for women's and men's soccer. And they've had an incredible run over the years. Many of those core values I stole from them. They were just too good. And then some other ones we changed and altered to fit the personality of the school where we are. We're at a private school, but it's not a religiously affiliated school. But we still wanted to make a difference in our players' personalities and our players' belief system. And we find that, you know, developing a strong set of values and talking about spirituality is a necessary part of anyone's college education, at least at our program. So, but that's really the genesis of it. The other thing is, you know, everybody downs millennials. You know, they say millennials are lazy or millennials are slackers or, you know, they have big hearts, but they don't have any action behind it. And, you know, our kids need to know that. They need to know there's a stigma out there about millennials. And they need to know what they can do about it to say, hey, look, yes, I'm in this generation, but I'm a leader of this generation, and here's what I stand for. And it all starts with you choosing to be positive. And that was our number one core value, and that's really coming from something that Mindy likes to talk about, that you actually get to choose your attitude. And, you know, I think John Wooden said life is 10% what happens to you and 90% how you react to that, how you handle it. And so choosing to be positive says that you, it's your choice to handle things the way that can be most effective, or you can do quite the opposite. And that's our number one value. So, but Mindy can talk more about why number one is we choose to be positive, because she has the attitude comment cornered.
And I think
so
that would be great.
Favorite...
Go ahead, Mindy.
Oh, sorry, Dave. I was going to add in what Paul said there. My favorite quote is, attitude is the mind's paintbrush. It can color any situation. The reason I actually have that quote is because I'm a pretty negative thinker and person naturally. So for me, it reinforces the type of person that I want to be, and just it challenged me to not let my own circumstance that I experienced to impact my dreams and my goals. And life can be hard. And I think that if we can help players develop life skill sets, then they're going to be more successful on the field, in the classroom, and when they get out into the real world and they're not protected necessarily by this college bubble. So that was a real importance to us to help shape their thinking.
Well, you also mentioned just now that, you know, this helps you. So let's just pause on that for a second and tell me what has, you know, working over the years with, again, and we can even drift into all the work you've done, you know, from the 9 and 10 year olds at your clinics to the club, middle schoolers, high schoolers. How has this sport changed you? And this is important because we're trying to get coaches to realize that as you try and change the kids in the right way, they'll change us in the right way, which is it's a great freebie to get out of this.
I'll address that, Dave. I think this has changed me in a way that, you know, I think the older that I get, the less that I know. And I say that, you know, with a lot of respect. I'm constantly wanting to learn from other people. I recognize, I guess, my weaknesses more sometimes as I get older, and I see certain patterns. And so I constantly like to be sharpened, and I like players that hold me accountable and coaches that hold me accountable. And, you know, when my goal has when my school has expectations, and, you know, I think it's really helpful to learn what works with people and environments and what doesn't. And every year, every dynamic's different. So that's a challenge in itself, you know, to be able to learn how to mold and grow as a coach and a person yourself, as well as help your players. And when they see that example in you growing and wanting to continue to learn with all of your experience that you have, and then I think the biggest difference that changes me and the program is serving. So one of the outside of our pyramid that I sent you, you know, we have family, love, and trust, which is the core entity of who we are and what we do, but then we have leadership and serve, and we want to get out in the community and give back. And when you take that focus off of yourself and you share the love of this game with other people, and that gave us, this game gave us an identity, and you can give that back to someone, there's no greater gift than giving back.
And on that topic there about the lead and the serve, because when I saw the pyramid, that immediately caught my attention, because people think to lead means to be in charge. So if you're team captain, you get to tell, you know, whoever gets to, you know, carry the equipment back, or you've got some sort of power over people. But it really means people want to follow you because you keep trying to find a way to serve them. And I think that's really not what pop sports culture says. You know, it's the true zero-sum game, just one winner. But that's what caught my eye the most in that pyramid, was that serving and leading were at the top. They just weren't, you know, also in there. And I think that's got to be challenging, especially as you bring in players that no doubt, wherever they came from, they were the hot athletic player. You bring them into your program, and they may not be, you know, just in relative terms, they may now be swimming in a much bigger pond. How do you help these kids adjust to kind of not retreat or get defensive and get combative, you know, to really see they're there to serve the team and the sport, you know, that makes all this possible?
I think there's a tremendous amount of vetting that goes into the recruiting process. We recruit families, not kids. So we're looking at moms and dads or aunts and uncles or guardians with a prospect. We want to kind of get a feeling of, you know, do they have chores to do at home? Do they work with families? Can they be a part of a family unit? Because the basis of everything that we do is family. Mindy and I are husband-wife team. Our daughter actually played for us as well for a time. And, you know, we invite anyone that participates in anything that we do to be a part of our family. So that's the first part. And we do the vetting with a lot of care and attention. And it's something that, like, there are no unimportant details. You know, John Gordon wrote The Energy Bus, and he said, you know, you get to choose the passengers on your bus. And I think those are the most important choices that we've had to make. Passengers, and that includes our coaching staff, that has to resonate with them, the core values, the family element. And we ask questions like, you know, how do you feel if your brother or sister does something that you don't like? And we'll try to see what they say. I like to talk about, hey, do you always like your brother? And people will say, no, I don't always like my brother. I'll say, right. You're not always going to like your teammates either, but you're going to love your teammates. That means you're going to give them grace to be the people they are, and they're going to make mistakes, and you're going to be okay with that. Just like you would be with your brother at home. And, you know, we teach in that context, the context of a really close family. And I think in the recruiting and screening process, questions of people and the families themselves. We're very leery of parents who do all the talking for their kids and who want to make their kids out to be the greatest player ever. The greatest player ever in lacrosse doesn't come to Jacksonville University. So we don't need to recruit that. We want to recruit the kids who are selfless and who care about passing the ball and setting a pick. And the reason why we've led the country in scoring four times is because we pass the ball better than anyone. And, you know, in order to be a good player for us, passing is a skill that you have to be very good at. And, you know, you can find a lot of players who can shoot. Everybody wants to try to score a goal. But can you find someone that can find the open player to make an easier shot than you? And I think those are all important. That's teaching life lessons and values on the field that are necessary to be successful in business or in a family in life, to be a good mom or a good parent.
Well, let me ask this now, because you're talking about family, and you'll see this again. I think I used this last week as well, was you watch Friday Night Tykes. And I think every one of those coaches, you know, very intense, over the top, they really do want what's best for the kids. But it turns more into one of those almost, you know, like a dark comedy of Thanksgiving, where it's family, and family means just yelling at each other as much as you can. And you forget about, oh, yeah, we're family in the end. What's your take on, again, building off of last week at PCA, the era of, you know, the abusive coach? It's my way or the highway. I know you all don't work that way. But how have you made that work, you know, if it's a family, a truly family, a warm environment, how do you keep them competitive? Because you've, I mean, for people that don't realize it, you've got some big time teams that come down there to play: Syracuse, Hopkins. It's not as if you know, you're just playing in a backwater league.
Things, and Mindy can do the rest. We handle it just like a family would handle it. So I have certain things that I do well, and Mindy has certain things that she does well. And together we can do great things. I think I stole that from Mother Teresa. But I think that our players, I'm in charge of systems and structure, and my background, my whole family is engineers except for me. I'm the dummy. So I'm a coach. But I'm really good at designing plays and things like that. So my engineering mind likes to organize practices to the minute. It is very exacting, has very high standards of fundamental development, and very, very conscious of that. The pace of practice that we have is crazy. A typical training session only lasts 90 minutes, but they never stop. They keep going and going and going. And so when we get to the games, they're very easy. The hard part is the mental side, and that's where Mindy comes in. She's got a master's in counseling, and she uses that on a daily basis. I do too, but I use it more from a coaching standpoint. Mindy uses it more from a team building, team bonding, individual achievement mentality. And then we have a sports psychologist that works with our athletes that really need that little extra help on focus. So it's an extremely competitive program, and we survey our players on a lot of different things. One of the surveys came back that almost all of our players are perfectionists. So that means they're harder on themselves than I'll be on them, and I can be quite hard on them. I would say I can be a taskmaster at times. But not all the time, only sometimes. And I think that differentiates me from maybe a Power 5 football coach who is trying to exact a means to an end for a bowl game. We don't look at it that way at all. We're a non-revenue producing sport. And so while I can be a taskmaster on the field, off the field, I want to be very active in helping our players get internships, helping our players develop their character. You know, being a positive coach doesn't mean you're a pushover. It means that you're dedicated to the positive outcome of your coaching that you want to see enhanced. And sometimes that means they have to work through some stuff. I want my kids to play sports so they learn how to work through some adversity, and that they learn not to fear adversity, that it's through adversity that they get stronger, and that they can do it by partnering with a coach, by partnering with teammates. So I do present a lot of adversity to the student athletes, there's no doubt, but I'm also their biggest fan. I believe in them more than I believe in myself sometimes, and I think that's the most important side of coaching is, and being a positive coach is recognizing that you're there to help develop their character, and you can do that through sports, and you can be a taskmaster sometimes and be someone that can cook burgers on your grill at home or take them for a boat ride in the intercoastal here in Jack. Like, there's so much you can do other than just coach in a demanding way. And I hope that I can present kind of that entire dichotomy of coaching to them.
Well, and I want to actually in a second ask Mindy about the counseling, but excuse me, real quick, I want to let everyone know if they have questions, they can call in at 646-716-7979. That's 646-716-7979. So, Mindy, you're a counselor with a team full of perfectionists, and perfectionists often tend to find a lot of complaints in others because they have complaints about themselves. So how do you, I mean, that's not a typical coaching background. Usually it's, you know, more sports related, non the counseling. How have you had to use that, knowing the typical mindset? And it's probably a very typical sports team mindset of perfectionists.
Well, I think that, you know, I've used counseling strategies with my team. Like, we have a 24-hour rule. That means if you feel defensive or offended by something, whether it's a coach, a teammate, a professor, a parent, anybody, that you have 24 hours to decide one of two things. You can confront them directly about how you feel about what they did or said that impacted you negatively, or you can let it go. But you can't gossip about it to someone else or drag the reputation of another person down. And I will tell you that, like, I will discipline that when people don't follow that over other, you know, behaviors. And to me, in counseling, when I would counsel people, I realized one thing, that 90% of problems were miscommunication. So one of our really important core values is mean no offense, take no offense. If we operate out of love, trust, and family, then we're human beings. People are going to let each other down. We're four coaches, and, you know, there's 30-some people. Everybody's going to interpret how something is delivered or how something is coached in a different way. It's our job to help players to manage up as much as manage each other or manage down to a younger kid, because in life, that's how the real world works. So having perfectionists on the team, I've, you know, worked greatly with our sports psychologist, Dr. Derek Mann, who's been wonderful at helping me to find a way with these personalities that have high expectation, they put high demands on themselves, high accountability, high desire, to not get into that, you know, that I have to be perfect, and when I make a mistake and get a criticism, how to learn how to accept that and take it and not let it, you know, affect their game where their peaks are as high and their valleys are as low. We're trying to get them to be more mainstream in recovering their emotions or their overload. And, you know, that's quite a great task, but it's also quite great strengths that they bring by having that personality style. So the third part of it is we have to teach about personality styles, that there's strengths and weaknesses to each. I might be a very likable person. That doesn't mean I know how to coach. Someone else might be a very demanding coach but have the best skill sets ever. So our job as head coaches is to build a team and a staff of people that balance each other's strengths and weaknesses, and to teach players how to learn what those are versus taking things personally or, you know, letting it affect their self-esteem or feeling victims of their circumstances. And when you get enough of people on the same page and there is not a social class feeling, which we don't allow, and what I mean by that, Dave, is freshmen don't do all of the chores. They don't do all the equipment. They don't, you know, they don't feel like freshmen. Freshmen should feel just like another member of every team. And it's called meritocracy. The best players play, and you're here to help recruit the best players to come into this program because you care about their playing time as much as yours. And you either buy into that vision, and we all think in the same way, although we're going to make mistakes, or you end up probably not staying a part of our culture.
And you talk about that meritocracy and not having the pecking order. I'll just refer back to last baseball season only because I guess I only get to celebrate the Cubs' victory every 108 years. But that team talked about how, and they have a guy like Joe Maddon who is a very, I mean, he's got sports psychologists on there. He's very much about the people and the personalities. But one of the things they talked about actually the year before when they suddenly went from in that rebuilding program saying, wait a minute, they're good. How did it happen? All the rookies said, they don't treat us like rookies. Everything we heard about, then you come up here, you get the worst batting practice time or whatever it is. There was none of that. And so you, like you say, all of a sudden now you start tapping into everybody's skills. It's not competitive. It's building. It is a meritocracy. You can only put so many players on the field, but if they're not trying to undermine each other, you know, whoever gets out there is pretty good. And, you know, in a team sport, you end up going to the bench. Let's pause for a second and let's go to one of the things that your players do, which is they help with local clinics. And I just, because my two younger girls were, kindergarten, first, second grade, and they would go to the clinics all the time in the fall. And your players are out there, and it was playtime, but that's part of that serving thing. And maybe you could start there with what your players do and what you all do with rec, whether it's reffing. Let's talk about the other end of the spectrum, what you're doing to really kind of, if not keep it on the good track, get it on good track, sports, so that what you're doing becomes the norm and not the unusual story that you hear.
Well, I guess I'll start with this and then Mindy can finish. We really want everyone to be exposed to the sport of lacrosse. We think that it's the original game of North America. It's the creator's game. It's a native game. And we think everyone should be exposed to it and decide if they want to try it or not. We don't think everyone needs to be a lacrosse player at all. I mean, we grew up playing every sport you could play, and I'm an advocate for playing as many sports and doing as many things child as you can, music included. But there's not that many people in our area that are lacrosse people. So the first thing we had to do was teach coaches how to coach and teach them the skills to coach. Help parents that are parent volunteer coaches to feel empowered to do drills. And simultaneously, we could also do these clinics with kids. And the coaches could come watch the clinics and learn how we teach the fundamentals. Our players benefit from every time they teach a skill. It just reinforces the concepts of how to do things properly for them. So, you know, they are serving selflessly, but they're getting something back. Every time you give, you get something back as well. So, you know, there's a lot to be said about that. And we try, now that we have games going on, our games are free. Kids can come to games. We have autograph signings for kids with posters. And we try to provide opportunities for kids that are playing the sport to see role models that could be them someday. And then kids that have never played before, we have probably 50 sticks or so that we'll take with us to do K through 8 clinic. And, you know, we'll do anything any youth league asks us to do, really, if we can make it fit, no matter when it is, spring or fall or summer or winter. It's just so important. And I think the game in our area has grown from around a couple hundred participants 10 years ago to probably 2,500 to 3,000 kids playing, and a high school state champion in our area, you know, and testimony to the coaches in our area who have learned and grown over the years and have put together successful programs. And I think it's about also learning the right way to play the game. You know, we teach skills the same that we teach our college kids, and I think that's really a key thing for young kids to learn. It doesn't have to be a curriculum that's made for a 7-year-old. You know, you can actually teach the same fundamentals to a 7-year-old that you look for in a college player. And I think that it's more fun to learn that way, and I think kids have more success when they can kind of grow into the fundamentals over time. So that's been terrific, and I think every day we kind of pinch ourselves because we get to work with kids, and there's nothing better than giving back the way that we had. We had some wonderful coaches growing up, Mindy and I, and you know, we really like to pay that forward.
Well, on that note, let's talk about, I guess, going back to your personal, talk about some great coaches. And I can remember my very first baseball coach was not a pushover by any means, but to yell. Started, and I'll also tell. For some reason, I was on either first or last place team, about almost 14. So got to the point to where through that it was just about places. But then you know you get to high school, and they can't always pick their coaches, and they're not trained. You know, going back 4 years, we ask this one at CA all the time, which is the supermarket story. Did you ever have a coach supermarket you'd try as opposed to running up to them? Did you have coaches that you had kind of, I hate to say so, but maybe, and you just kind of get through, fortunate to have nothing but good coaches as you grew up?
I guess talk about my coaches. My coaches were very integral in my life because I was the first person to go to college in my family. And so, you know, the value of education wasn't necessarily reinforced, and sports kind of gave me that avenue. So my mentors and coaches provided that mechanism, but they also provided the mechanism of teamwork, accountability, you know, mentoring. Like when I messed up, you know, I knew it, and there was accountability to it, and they taught me how to take that accountability, but also, you know, how to believe in myself and push myself to another level. And, I've always seen in different programs that I've played in that, you know, everyone can have different feelings about coaches. But I always believe that regardless of a coaching style, like there's something you can learn from a coach. Even if it's a coach you don't like or perceived as likable, or you don't think they're very good teachers, there's something you can learn from every person if you keep open-minded. And I think that, like, sometimes when parents at certain ages, they have to fight that battle. But there's times where I think the best relationships I established with my coaches was when I could go into a room and communicate with them, and we could develop a relationship by understanding each other and, you know, learning their expectations for me and how they made decisions and what their how I could understand how they were coaching me. And to me, I think it's a real win-win situation when parents and players put the process back into the players' hands to be, to learn how to communicate with their coaches and to work with them and gain value for what their strengths are and take that into then what they do in their personal lives.
And I've liked, so I guess for other people, I've got freshman at college, sophomore in high school, grader. So by a variety of, you know, simple club, high school, and where it's going currently. And I'll have to say that the clubs in lacrosse, the clubs that my daughter play with, as intense as they are, they start from the right place. And the whole idea of this their people. And the thing that they mentioned is what you just talked about, which is it's a journey, because there aren't really any jobs related to lacrosse. Maybe you might find something, you know, that's closely related, but for the most part, it's about the journey. And as you said, the college experience. And with that, maybe we can switch towards now, because your daughter Taylor has been through it as an athlete. And we were talking about the current state of recruiting, which today on my kitchen table, Lacrosse Magazine talks about the troubled state of early recruiting. And for those who don't know, they're talking to rising freshmen as about where they'd like to go to college when they have no idea what they want to do in high school. And again, this isn't so much about coaching, somehow now the sport that's there to be that journey for them and the opportunity. Maybe you guys can tell what you think it's got some adjusting to do with the recruiters.
Yes. I know the IWLCA, which is the Women's Lacrosse Coaches Association. They've done a great job of sponsoring legislation that seeks to impose limits on when you can start the recruiting process. And I think that's needed. That being said, it all comes from the business side of sports, the early recruiting. It starts with club programs seeking establishment and dominance through their placement of prospects to name brand institutions. It goes rivals, name brand institution rivals, going after the top prospects to try to get the top kids and, you know, at the best tournaments, the tournaments that are run by the association. So I think there's this perfect storm of incredible businesses that do a great job with the club programs to put kids out there. Incredible tournaments where thousands of kids can play in a weekend and every college coach can be there to watch them. So that speeds things up. And then you have extraordinary reputation, their ability to place kids, and where the top programs want to have a top recruiting class. And to do that, they have to get after these young prospects and get them before someone else does. So it's a perfect storm that has accelerated the process, and no one's honestly to blame. It's a couple of different systems colliding. So in order to fix that system, you actually have to have a rule put out there that says, hey, look, you can't talk to someone about the recruiting process until this date. And I don't know if it'll pass. I'm hopeful it will. If it does pass, that'll be terrific. If it doesn't go through, then we'll be in the current state, which is unregulated in terms of, if a high school prospect, a ninth grader, wants to call me and talk about coming to my school, I'm perfectly able to speak with them as long as they initiate the contact or if they're on my campus. And this has trickled down with eighth graders going to visit campuses, especially in hotbeds like Maryland and New York. You can just drive to any number of colleges and get on their campus and have a recruiting conversation with someone. The risks and dangers of early recruiting are easy to understand, but the irrational exuberance that comes with recruiting the number one eighth grader sometimes gets the better of the coaches, and it can get the better of the parents as well. Many parents would like to say at a cocktail party or a get-together, hey, my daughter is committed to Penn State, or my daughter is committed to Maryland, or my daughter is committed to Harvard, just because, you know, it's good conversation. But is it the right fit? I think it takes time to find the right fit. And, you know, the negative side of early recruiting is there's a lot of kids that are going to change with incredible volatility from the time they commit to the time they show up. And there's a lot of coaching changes that are going to occur from the time a kid commits to the time they show up. Very messy process, even more unexact. You know, recruiting's not an exact science as it is. Even when you recruit juniors and seniors, it's not even close to being an exact science. Coaches make mistakes and players make mistakes. But all you're doing is creating more volatility in that process by taking an eighth grader or a ninth grader. What ends up occurring is parents do the recruiting for the kids. I don't know very many eighth graders that are really worried about the academic reputation of the school they choose. I haven't found that many eighth graders who are dreaming of going to an Ivy League school. They don't even know what the Ivy League is. So when they start committing to an Ivy League school when they haven't even taken a PSAT, it's a little bit weird. And that's 100% driven by a parental expectation. Hey, I want my kid to go to fill-in-the-blank school. So the same thing happens with the big business of college sports. when you have Power 5 schools that generate $85 to $100 million a year in revenue between football and basketball, and those sports are in an extremely competitive environment, it's a business. When the non-revenue sports start becoming a business and follow that model, with the perfect storm that lacrosse has, it gets really crazy. And you'll see, kids committing, entire classes committing before they're a sophomore to certain schools. And the negative side of that is, I don't know if you know the Little League baseball stories, but very few kids that play in the Little League World Series, the best kids, few of them end up being good college players or pros. And so if you're taking kids that are eighth graders, 12 or 13-year-old kids, and then you're trying to forecast what their life's going to be like in high school. You know, when my daughter was in eighth grade, I just was happy if she could clean her room. I wasn't thinking she was going to make a decision on a room at a college somewhere. There's no way. I mean, we had no idea what was going to happen in her life over that span of time. So, again, the incredible volatility, definitely – it's parents playing with fire. It's college coaches playing with fire. And from my standpoint, because Jacksonville is not a Power 5 school, we don't really see it as a revenue driver. We see it as a life changer. And someone might decommit from our school. That's fine. Decommit from our school. But that saves us a lot of headaches down the road. And someone else will show up and say, hey, I want to come to your school, and I missed out on the process because I was playing club soccer and I decided I don't like soccer anymore. Great. I'll take an incredible athlete that plays multiple sports and wants to play lacrosse now and is really excited. Those types of things happen every month. It happens. And I think there's incredible parity that's being established, because the volatility that the Power 5 schools are experiencing as a result of wanting to get the best eighth graders is trickling down to the mid-major level, and a lot of mid-major teams are getting better players at later times to play for them. So I'm just fine with early recruiting if it stays the same, because we're going to draw a line and not go as young as some of these teams are going.
The system, you're not going to do a service to the kids. And that's one of the, again, it's been so interesting for me, again, with one of my daughters being a sophomore, that is all this going on about the time she was a rising freshman. They made it real clear. This is about the club. They were exposing them here, about the reality. And it was them saying, well, number one, free ride. And across Title IX, not a moneymaker like that. You either go to a school that you'd go to if you weren't playing lacrosse. And then they talk about what the real advantage was. You were good enough by general, but maybe by that year, there just were with slightly higher scores than you. But as you were saying before, it's a place that successful, but the edge was to help you of year, and that is a real opportunity, because like Mindy, I'm also for the most student, and you want to get in. I was definitely not a straight A student. I went to an engineering program. Paul, I guess along with your family, that sounds what I want to talk about. But I definitely watched, as I got through high school and then the college, my grades went down every year, but I loved it more and more. So, I was fortunate to get in. But there were other programs, again, if there had been more kids that year, maybe not. So I think that's where these kids, as mentors, the coaches, that straight talk, and club coaches, the best, telling them, here's what you can get out of it. Be smart. So that does that school even offer the major you want? And maybe you can talk a little bit as parents, I think senior, share about your daughter that, there's a, it's so easy to just rationalize that, no, no, it's the best thing for that kid. It's okay. It's still good for that kid. But really, it's not, you know, the best thing that for them in their college experience. So could you talk a little bit about this, what some of the things that Taylor had gone through?
Sure, I can talk about that, and Paul, feel free to add in. You know, I think as a parent, you always want to have your kid be happy, although we're coaches, so we realize, what does happiness mean? You know, happiness to me as a parent is that recognizing your kid's going to have to grow, and growing happens in all sorts of ways, and allowing that process is important. But that they're, number one, can have the educational experience that they want. Number two, they can work to meet their goals on the field. And three, they can come up with some lifelong friendships and get a great job. So, you know, you try to work through the right fit. And I will say, I was one of those kids in the re-recruiting process at the you know, big school name. Who doesn't want to go to the big school name? You know, it's a natural feeling to be attracted to that. And I'm totally fine with that. I think it's a right fit for a lot of people. You know, but really at the end of the day, can you, like you said, Dave, can you major in what you want to major in? And, you know, I think, you know, when Taylor decided to transfer, you know, she wanted a place where she could maybe get a better social connection with her teammates, to become friends, maybe a better playing opportunity. And, you know, and so she gave us a month to reopen the recruiting process, and we were like, wow, this is, we got to go through this again. But, you know, we did allow her to be a part of making the decision. And I don't think, you know, I don't want to see a kid transfer, but it's also not the worst situation. I mean, you know, the grass might be greener somewhere else, it might not, but, you know, you have to help your kids work through the process on why they're choosing what they're choosing and for what reasons. And if you always come back to education, which is really what, you know, Taylor wanted to be in a business school, and she wanted to do something with business, and, you know, she was fortunate through tearing her ACL her senior year at JU to stay one more year and do the one-year MBA program, and has ended up with a wonderful job in risk management at Black Knight Financial Services and a great job. So even some adversity that she experienced ended up really working to her benefit. And, you know, and but I always say, go where you're loved. You know, like you have to go somewhere where what you're looking for and the goals that you think you're intending to achieve academically, athletically, socially, personally, you have people in your corner that also want to help you achieve it. And I think that's why you have to ask really good questions as parents. You have to ask really good questions as players, and you have to talk to the team as well as the coaches, and, you know, really take your time to make sure it's the right fit. And at the end of the day, if it's not the right fit, that's okay too. Don't ruin it for other players that are there. You know, like, you know, whatever your issues are, maybe it's working for other people. So we live in America. We have free choice. Go find a place that's better for you. And so I don't think that transferring is the worst possible situation, but Taylor's gained a lot of valuable experience through going through the recruiting process twice. And then she, you know, she found the right fit and was able to now, after 5 years, do what you want as a parent, which is turn the bills over to your child because they become independent, you know, people on their own, that they're able to live in a way that helps them to grow into their own professional life.
Yeah.
Go
ahead.
Oh, I wanted to add on, you know, the academic experience is so critical. And as parents and coaches, and Mindy and I both played at Division III schools. So we studied whatever we wanted to study. And I don't think that should change because you're playing a non-revenue sport at Division I. So it's something every parent should ask on a visit, you know, or every kid. Hey, I want to study nursing. How many nurses have graduated from your program? Not can I study nursing here, but how many have actually made it through your program and graduated with this degree? And I think, you know, or what do your student athletes study here? What who studies what on this program? And if you want to study business, but everyone is doing like event planning instead, you have to wonder, like, why would I send my child to a school where they can't actually get the degree at the end of 4 years that they need to succeed or that might be in their aptitude realm? And I just think we call it the one-end rule. Be able to have one and the other, your academics and your athletics, not one or the other.
Absolutely.
And, you know, that's critical to making a good fit. And how do you even know what you want to study when you're 13? So, you know, again, it's something between early recruiting and academic freedom and choice. I think there's a lot to be said for being diligent and patient in the recruiting process.
Yeah, and talk about the end game with getting the job and local government here. One of middle school club was up and playing, which is, again, these were their freshmen, brings over the coaches who was players, and he wants a story about her. It had nothing to do with her playing. And you can give the backstory on this, but about how multiple job offers. She just graduated. She had multiple job offers, took a great one. In fact, it wasn't, she had made a bad choice, but what the coach, and he's one of the coordinators for the age group, who, yes, very intense about play hard. There's coaches watching, you know, this is your opportunity. But the opportunity is athlete and get a great job. And maybe you could just tell who that athlete was, because she was not your number one recruit. It was a great story about what we want all kids to get out of.
Yeah, Mindy recruited this young lady. Her name's Tori, and she was a late recruit, someone who came by after we were done with our class, but we had a spot available, so we gave our spot to her. And Tori, her first 3 years, didn't really play that much. Her senior year, she was a role player on our offense and did a great job, but she was actually busy double majoring in finance and accounting. And she had done some internship work with my business that I run, and she was terrific. She could run an office. She could basically figure out internal processes for bookkeeping and do your taxes too. So she was a dynamo. And she actually got a great job at PricewaterhouseCooper and turned down Georgetown Business School so she could get this great job that kids out of college don't normally get. And, you know, I tried to beg her to stay working for me full time, but she passed on that offer.
Hey, Paul, I hate to cut you off. Just make sure everyone heard that story, because we're about out of time. I definitely want to thank you, welcome you two back to the show another time, because I think we have a lot more to talk about. So, again,
thank you, Dave.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, who's listening. And look for the replay on this.
Anything.
This is Paul Mincourt, Coach of Jackson.
I can do what I want.
So, again, thank you, everybody.
Coach on Fire Radio.